Okay, today we are going to do the Akedah through the eyes of the Hasidim and Kierkegaard, with whom we are going to begin. Let me start with Kierkegaard, who is the only non-Jewish commentator that we are going to focus on, even though obviously the Akedah has a place in Christian as well as Muslim tradition. In fact, there's even a Muslim holiday, as you may know, to celebrate the Akedah, which makes it more central in some ways than in Judaism.
Which one?
The holiday of the Akedah. Kierkegaard, the Akedah plays a part in Christianity because the central theme of Christianity is sacrifice. And Kierkegaard, who was a Danish theologian, and his dates, he lived in the middle of the 19th century. And the book was written in like the 1840s or 50s, I think the 1840s. Kierkegaard wrote an entire book on the Akedah called Fear and Trembling. And I will explain what his theory is about the Akedah, but first I want to read you one of the opening passages, okay? This is his midrash, his way of rendering it. On the morning of the fourth day, Abraham never said a word, but he lifted his eyes and saw Mount Moriah from far off. He left the young man behind and went on with Isaac. But Abraham said to himself, I will not conceal from Isaac where this course will lead him. He stood still, he laid his hand on Isaac in benediction, and Isaac bowed to receive the blessing. And Abraham's face was fatherliness, his look was mild, his speech encouraging. But Isaac was unable to understand him. His soul could not be exalted. He fell to Abraham's knees at his feet imploringly, begged for his young life, his hope for the future. He called to mind the joy in Abraham's house, the sorrow and the loneliness. Then Abraham lifted the boy, walked with him by his side, and his talk was full of comfort. But Isaac didn't understand him. He climbed Mount Moriah, but Isaac still could not understand him. Then for an instant he turned away. And when Isaac saw again Abraham's face, it was changed. His glance was wild. His form was horror. He seized Isaac by the throat, threw him to the ground, and said, Stupid boy, do you suppose that I'm your father? I'm an idolater. Do you suppose this is God's will? This is my desire. Isaac trembled and cried out in terror, O God in heaven, have compassion on me. God of Abraham, have compassion on me. If I have no father on earth, you be my father. But Abraham in a low voice said to himself, O God in heaven, I thank you. After all, it is better for him to believe that I am a monster than to lose faith in you. An amazing passage. I think you'll agree. And that is the opening of the book. Kierkegaard's theory of the Akedah, which is a very controversial one in Christianity, and especially there is a Jewish, there's a wonderful essay about Kierkegaard in general and about his theory in particular by a rabbi named Milton Steinberg, which argues with it. Kierkegaard's theory of the Akedah is what he calls it in the book a teleological suspension of the ethical. I'll explain what that is. Teleology means doing something for a purpose, right? Teleological is to an end, right? It's a term that comes from Aristotle. And for a specific end, it suspends the ethical. In other words, what you're supposed to do no longer counts. As far as Kierkegaard is concerned, and I mentioned this theory last time, the reason that God praises Abraham is not because Abraham was ready to sacrifice his son. Because Kierkegaard does not believe that Abraham believed that he would kill his son in the end. Rather, Abraham's faith was, despite the fact that God tells him to kill his son, and he will do it, he trusts God's previous promise that somehow offspring will come through Isaac. So in other words, Abraham's ready to kill Isaac not so much because God told him to, but because he trusts God so much from before that he'll do anything because he's sure that God will fulfill the promise. Okay? Now you can hear, by the way, in the background here, the Christian theme of God can kill someone and still make, through resurrection, still make what they promise come true. But his deeper theme is that Abraham did this in accord with no rule. There is no single rule that fits Abraham's action. You can't say every time God says you should kill someone, you should do it. You can't say that you should always listen to what you think God says. As far as he's concerned, this was a unique situation where Abraham put himself outside everyone in the human community. Nobody, according to normal standards, would approve of what Abraham did. And therefore, he calls him a knight of faith. And in a very famous phrase that comes from this book, said that Abraham took a leap of faith. And it's a leap because it doesn't make any sense to go from here to there, right? Abraham had to jump over all the normal categories and say, I'm going to do this even though it doesn't make any sense. And therefore, for Kierkegaard, Abraham is the greatest example of faith because he did something out of his sense of what God wants that was in violation of all moral, ethical, and other standards. Okay? Now, as you'll see when you hear, I'll talk a little bit more about it, as you'll see when you hear from some of the Hasidic tradition, this has some resonance in the Hasidic tradition, but by and large, Jews reject this understanding because the ethical law is never supposed to be entirely suspended. And I say entirely because the Hasidic understanding is not completely. And I'll tell you what I mean. First of all, there are two principles in Jewish law that sometimes are applied to the Akedah. One is Eit La'asot L'Adonai, which is it's a time to do for God, Hefer et Toratecha, which means we have violated or broken your law. And say the rabbis, there are times when you have to violate Jewish law in order to fulfill it, right? And you can imagine examples of that, although the Akedah is clearly an extreme one, times when, let's say, you have to lie to save your life. And since life is a law and telling the truth is a law, you violate the law to save the law. That's an easy example. The other principle is mitzvah haba'ah ve'averah, a mitzvah that comes to be through a sin. And here, too, you can think of an example. Let's take an easy example. Let's say you have to, somebody's on a drug and they're going wild and they're going to hurt someone, so you knock them out. A mitzvah that comes through a sin. Now, this principle, that's an easy one, but this principle obviously can be easily violated. And in fact, if you know the story of Shabtai Tzvi, the false messiah, this was a principle that Shabtai Tzvi used a lot, and so did his followers, and not always to good effect. But now let's look at specifically at how the Hasidim read the story, and that will give you a better sense of how these principles are applied to the Akedah in particular, and look at it through the eyes of both Kierkegaard and the Hasidim. Okay. Now, here is the trial for the Hasidim. Remember, for Kierkegaard, for standard Jewish tradition, the trial is that Abraham has to kill his son. Okay? For Kierkegaard, the trial is that Abraham has to believe God's previous promises and therefore be willing to kill his son because he believes what God already says. For the Hasidim, the trial of Abraham is to achieve bitul hayesh. Bitul hayesh means the nullification of the self. He has to be willing to be an instrument for God. And in fact, in Hasidic tradition, the trial of the Akedah was not hard for Abraham. Because the difficulty of the Akedah is the difficulty of the ego. What you love, what you're not supposed to do. Right? It's God told me to do this, but I'm not supposed to do this. After all, I love my son, and I'm an ethical person. But if you achieve bitul hayesh, if you achieve the nullification of the self, then you become entirely a tool of God, so to speak. And therefore, when you read most of the Hasidic sources, unlike the rabbinic sources, and remember, rabbinic sources are the rabbis who wrote the Talmud, some 1,500 years before there was a Hasidism, a little less. Talmud finished about 1,000 years before. For the rabbis of the Talmud, it's a great difficulty. This is Abraham's 10th trial and the hardest one, because he loves his son. For the Hasidim, that love should be nullified in a way, because you take entirely in the spirit of God, and your ego should not have any part in your action. Okay? That's the most common Hasidic source. The conflict of it in Hasidic tradition is that Abraham feels love for God and feels love for his son. But the extent to which love for his son asserts itself, what has to diminish? Love for God. And therefore, if love for God is complete, he doesn't feel at that moment love for his son, which to us seems horrible, but actually to the Hasidim is the ideal. Right? At that moment, his love should be entirely for God, and therefore he should be able to do what God asks him without qualms. A different way, you'll agree, of seeing this from any we have seen so far. Okay. Let's now look at the story, and let's go through it as the Hasidim would read it. Okay? Sometime after chapter 22 of the Book of Genesis. Okay, sometime afterward, God puts Abraham to the test. And up to now, we've just been talking about what the test is. Okay? He said to him, Abraham. And he answered, Hineni. He answers, Here I am. The answer that he gives to God at that moment means, I am fully present for you. And the ability to be fully present for God means to not be present elsewhere. So that's at least, this is the Hasidic reading, that he is entirely ready to do whatever it is that God asks of him, which is why it's repeated again at the end. And he said, Take your son, your favorite son, whom you love. Now we know by now that this is the Hebrew reading of it, right? Take your son, your favorite son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the heights that I'll point out to you. Now, in the Hasidic reading, remember, Moriah is going to become what?
Jerusalem,
the temple. He knows prophetically that it's going to be the temple. Right? So this is God, so Abraham knows that this is an important central place that God is asking him to bring his son, and he already knows, as we said before, that it's going to be a sacrifice, even though you don't have to read it that way. All right. Because we talked about that last time, and we'll talk about next time how you can read this, that Abraham never intended to do it. Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. So Abraham gets up in the morning, and he saddles his ass, and he takes his two servants and his son Isaac, and he splits the wood, and he sets out for the place that God had told him. This is Abraham's second journey, right? The first Lech Lecha and the second Lech Lecha. And both of them, remember what Lech Lecha can mean? Right, going to yourself. Okay. But when Abraham goes to himself at the end, Lech Lecha, by the way, go to yourself is a Hasidic reading. When Abraham goes to himself at the beginning, he goes to a different self from the self that he goes to now. Because now he's had a lifetime of closeness to God. Then he had just come to know God. Okay, and now he has had also a lifetime of training in egolessness, which is for Hasidim the highest rung. Okay, to divest yourself of your ego and to fill yourself with God. This is why when you go to a Hasidic rabbi for counseling, that's the principle quality that they're supposed to embody is bitul hayesh. They're supposed to empty themselves of themselves, fill themselves with you, and return you to yourself. That's how you're supposed to know what someone needs, not because you know, but because at that moment you channel them, so to speak, back to themselves. On the third day, Avraham looks and he sees the place from afar. The question here, according to, as I said, the one theory, is Abraham going to favor Judaism or God? That is, Abraham, Isaac represents Judaism, the continuity of the tradition. God right now represents the destruction of the tradition. But that's what God's asking for. God's asking Abraham to destroy his tradition, his future, his genealogy, in favor of God's will. And because Abraham does not himself have ego, he'll do it. And in fact, this reminds us, I think I read it once before, but it has the same Hineni aspect and is worth remembering, of the story of Shmuel. Do you remember when Shmuel is a child, and he comes to the house of Eli, and Eli is no longer going to be the high priest, but Shmuel doesn't know that. Shmuel's mother Hannah has prayed, and she says to God, "If you give me a child, I'll devote the child to your service." God gives her a child, and so now young Samuel grew up in the service of the Lord under Eli. In those days, the word of the Lord was rare. Prophecy was not widespread. One day, Eli was asleep in his usual place. His eyes had begun to fail, and he could barely see. The lamp of God had not gone out, and Samuel was sleeping in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. The Lord called out to Samuel, and he answered, "Hineni, I'm here." He ran to Eli and said, "You called me, here I am." In other words, at this point, according to the Hasidic reading, Samuel's only reality is Eli. He's completely there for him because that's his master and he's an apprentice, he's a kid. Eli replied, "I didn't call you, go back to sleep." So he went back and lay down. Again, the Lord called Samuel. Samuel rose and went to Eli and said, "Hineni, here I am, you called me," right? But he replied, "I didn't call my son, go back to sleep." Eli now is getting annoyed. Now, Samuel had not yet experienced the Lord, okay? The word of the Lord had not been revealed to him. Now, those are two different statements. The first is he never experienced God. Therefore, he couldn't say Hineni to God because he hadn't experienced him. And second, he'd never heard God's voice, okay? The Lord called Samuel again a third time, and he rose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." Then Eli understood, because you see, he is older and experienced, that the Lord was calling to the boy, and Eli said, "Go lie down. If you're called again, say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" And Samuel went to the place and lay down. The Lord came, stood there, and called as before, "Samuel, Samuel." Remind you of something? At the end of the Akedah, what happens? Abraham, Abraham, right. And Samuel said, "Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening." And then what God goes on to tell him is the house of Eli is going to be destroyed. And the next morning, of course, Eli says, "So what did God say?" And Samuel doesn't want to tell him. But Eli says, "You have to tell me." And he tells him what's going to happen. Because Eli has rotten kids too, as it turns out. And in fact, Shmuel becomes the last prophetic leader, in a way, before the political leaders take over. It is Samuel who anoints Saul as king, and then later anoints David when Saul turns out not to be the king. But you see the dynamic here is that, according now, reading this through a Hasidic lens, he wasn't ready to say Hineni to God because he couldn't fill himself with God since he didn't know God. And Abraham now can fill himself with God, and therefore this entire trial for a Hasidic reading isn't a trial. It is a trial, but it's not a trial to sacrifice Isaac. It's a trial to conquer Abraham's inner resistance, which has to do with what he loves, what he's attached to, and what he wants. Right? It's not what God wants. And here's where you can see how the Hasidic tradition and Kierkegaard come together. Because for both of them, the idea is less that Abraham is going to do this terrible thing because God says so, than there is this unique position that someone like Abraham stands in that other human beings can't imagine being in, right? In one case, because he has this assignment from God that makes no sense. And for Kierkegaard, the fact that it makes no sense makes it more that God told him to do it. and more likely that Abraham would see himself outside of the regular world of people, right? The more ridiculous the idea, the more likely that it wasn't a human invention, which is the same argument, of course, that Christianity makes about Jesus on the cross, right? The more ridiculous the idea, the more chance that it's divine and not human. We can talk about that if you want. And for the Hasidim, it's not at all about the conflict in Abraham about killing his son. It's about the conflict in Abraham about Abraham. It's very, as the Hasidic tradition often tends to be, it's very oriented towards the growth and development of the individual soul. It's really about what goes on inside of Abraham and not about how Abraham is going to treat Isaac. Yeah.
Humility that comes with that breaking.
Well, the one thing I would say is that that's, a nice midrash on a midrash. Remember, the breaking of the idols is a midrash. It's not in the Bible. So I think that it is, from the point of view especially of Hasidim, the paradigm of being broken and being whole is a very powerful one. You know, it was the Kotzke Rebbe or Rabbi Nachman, it's quoted in both their names, that the only whole heart is a broken one. And that's how they explain the shofar also. Remember, when you blow the shofar, what do you do? First you blow a long, a tekiah, then truah, which is three broken notes, and then shvarim. And shvarim, which are the little blasts, come from the word shever, which means brokenness. But at the end, what do? You do a tekiah gedolah, right. You are broken and then reconstruct yourself based on the brokenness. It's what the Yehuda HaChassid has a beautiful phrase. Yehuda HaChassid was a member of the original Hasidim, some 700 or 800 years before the Hasidim that we're talking about, the German pietist. He said, "I will make an altar to God from the fragments of my broken heart." Right? And an altar, of course, you have to put them back together to make one thing. Yes?
What do the Hasidim say about the 3 days in the...
So, okay, I'm glad you mentioned that. What do the Hasidim say about the 3 days in the wilderness? They use a lot of the same midrashim that that the Talmud does, but even more, the Hasidim, if you read the stories of Isaac Basheva Singer, which will give you a feel for that world, right? Or many other, I just read a novel called In Polish Woods by Apu Tashu, who is another Yiddish writer. You'll see that there's a lot of folk magic and superstition in the Hasidic world. And they elaborate greatly on the things that Satan did to try to prevent Abraham from carrying this out, because Satan's appeal is to ego. So for example, which is how Satan starts. We read the story of Adam and Eve, right? What does he say? You'll be like a god, right? If you eat the fruit. So he tells Abraham how he could be a great nation, and God's trying to take that away from him, and didn't he promise him he'd be a great nation? He shouldn't do this because, you know, he's a father and Isaac loves him and he loves Isaac. In other words, it's a strange inversion in a way, because all the things that we would say to a father who's going to do this become representative of evil because God's told him to do the opposite.
And Kierkegaard is Christian?
Yes, Kierkegaard is Protestant. He's a Danish Protestant Christian. And his view of this is that the knight of faith is someone who puts himself completely outside social rules for a moment, not forever, but for a moment, in this unique situation where he's received this direct command from God. And part of this, by the way, is Kierkegaard himself was a bit of an outcast. So there is probably that as well. But he puts himself completely outside because the rules by which human beings run their lives are rules that are important and central 99% of the time. And most people are unable to distinguish that key moment when you have to be able to stand outside the system. And that's what Abraham does. And as you can see, this is clearly an interpretation that lends itself to tremendous abuse, because everybody thinks they stand outside the system. There's another tradition in philosophy of this that comes from Nietzsche, and you can also read in Dostoevsky about an Übermensch, somebody who's a superman, right? If you ever read Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, it's because someone thinks they're greater than social rules, and therefore he kills this woman because she stands in his way, and he's greater. And Kierkegaard does not actually support that. The whole point of Kierkegaard's like the Hasidim, the point of Kierkegaard standing outside the social rules is submission, right? It's because you are doing the inscrutable, that means the ununderstandable will of God at this moment. And no social system or social laws can encompass that or understand it. And you see that, by the way, a lot in the Hasidic tradition. It's the tension that the Hasidim have between the halakha, between Jewish law, and spirit. So when people go off to the woods and scream and pray, or when Shabtai Tzvi got married to the Torah, which was a sort of exaggeration of this idea, it was because they felt that they had this direct relationship to God and didn't have to be mediated always by the law. Yeah.
So is this the way to explain the Jewish history, that all this years of suffering, and this suffering is for a good cause, and
well,
Holocaust, do they,
it depends who. I want to say this Hasidism is a tradition, but there are lots of different Hasidic rabbis. So they explain it all the way that the tradition explains it. The most, I would say they fall into several different categories, but what ties into the Akedah is Yisurin Shel Ahava, the sufferings of love, that the afflictions that the Jewish people have borne are a sign of love, not a sign of hatred, and that God's love has designated us as the ones who will bear that suffering in the way, by the way, that Isaiah 53 talks about, which Jews don't talk about very much because it's the chapter that Christians use to illustrate Jesus. But Isaiah 53 talks about a people that will suffer on behalf of other people. And there is that, you know, there is that idea clearly in the Hasidic tradition that Jews are suffering for the sins of others, for the sins of humanity and also for the sins of the Jewish people. There's some of that. I mean, there's also suffering as refinement. There's suffering as, you know, God doesn't give you burdens you can't bear. And there is a lot of, remember that this was a society where people made clay vessels a lot. And what do you have to do with a clay vessel to harden it? You have to put it in the kiln and you have to fire it up. And there is a lot of that idea that that's how you purge the impurities and so on. But I wouldn't say that that's the predominant one. The predominant one is the one that Jews have always felt is predominant, at least until post-Holocaust, which is mipnei chataeinu, because of our sins. And even then, I mean, even in the Second World War, that's what rabbis were encouraging, was people to repent, when Rabbi Hauptman was here, Judith Hauptman, the Talmud scholar, I was sitting next to her during services and I showed her this interpretation for that week's Parsha, which I don't even remember what the Parsha was, but it was something about one of the biblical heroes who at one point had sat. And the comment was, that's what you're supposed to do in times of suffering. You're supposed to sit and make sure that you don't run away, because running away shows a lack of faith in God. And I said, this is exactly the kind of interpretation that doomed Jews of Eastern Europe.
Right.
Of course. Well, it isn't that it invites more. It's that if they'd come to America, they would have lived. Or gone to Israel, they would have lived. But many rabbis throughout Eastern Europe said it shows a lack of faith to run away. So, which was, by the way, I just want to say, that was, you know, it sounds foolish now, but remember that Nazism was unprecedented. Jews had always stayed and they always survived. Maybe some of them got killed. Maybe they had to go to an adjoining country. But the notion that someone was going to sweep across all the nations, transnationally and round up Jews and kill them, it had never happened before in history to any people, much less to Jews. So for them to foresee it was not easy. I mean, some people did, but they didn't. Yeah. So I was waiting for this point to come up because this is exactly why the idea that Abraham erases Isaac, which is exactly what this Hasidic strain suggests, right? Bitulei Yesh, you have no ego. That's what Buber came to identify the strain of Hasidism that's supposed to correct. For Buber highlights the Hasidic tradition that is the interpersonal tradition, as opposed to the interpersonal, as opposed to the intrapersonal, as opposed to just inside you. For Buber, Buber says all real living is meeting, that there is no moral growth except in relationship. This is also a modern French philosopher named Levinas, who's a Jewish philosopher also, talks about this. Insistence is that actually you come to shape yourself only through interaction with the other. And this is, he's built a whole philosophy of Judaism around this, which is actually worth a class in and of itself. The Hasidic tradition that sees interpersonal relationship as central wouldn't identify Abraham's struggle as purely interpersonal. The reason that I highlight that aspect of Hasidic tradition is that's what differs from the Talmudic tradition. But I don't want you to think that that's the only Hasidic reading. It's only the one that we haven't heard yet, which is why I bring it, right? The rest of the Hasidic tradition obviously sees this as the way the Talmud does, which is a struggle struggle of faith. Let me put it that way. A struggle to believe that this is the right thing to do in spite of the fact that it violates all of Abraham's ethical norms. When you go to the end of the story, which we've read several times, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read you one or two selected parts. Next time, we're going to do our final verse-by-verse reading with all the modern commentaries, many of which differ from everything we've talked about so far, unsurprisingly. Here's the question. It says, they arrived at, verse 9, they arrived at the place of which God had told him. Abraham built an altar there. He laid out the wood. He bound his son Isaac, laid him on the altar on top of the wood, and Abraham picked up the knife to slay his son. Then an angel of the Lord called him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. And he answered, here I am. And he said, do not raise your hand against the boy or do anything to him, for now I know you fear God, since you haven't withheld your son, your favored one, from me. Now, the story could end there, right? That could be enough. But it doesn't end there. When Abraham looked up, his eye fell upon a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering in place of his son. And Abraham named that site Adonai Yireh, whence the present saying, on the mount of the Lord there's a vision. The angel of the Lord calls a second time and said, by myself I swear, the Lord declares, because you've done this and haven't withheld your son, your favorite son, and on, I'll bestow my blessing upon you. So we mentioned last time the idea that God doesn't bless Abraham until he makes a voluntary sacrifice, right? The first sacrifice was commanded, the sacrifice of Isaac. Then God just says, okay, now I know you love me. Abraham goes back and makes a voluntary sacrifice, and then he gets this blessing, right? The ram, according to rabbinic tradition, was one of six things that were created at the beginning of time and has been waiting there for Abraham since then, because Notice that it says that he looks up with the same verse 13. Vayisa Avraham et Einav. Abraham looks up and sees. Now, where have we seen that phrase before? Right. Look back at verse. Whoops. They have thin pages to make the book not too big. Look back at verse. Four. Vayom Hashlishi, Vayisa Avraham et Einav. Abraham raises his eyes. The mountain was waiting for him, and the ram was waiting for him. Now that connection then becomes redemption is going to come from Zion, right? Which is the mount associated with the Temple Mount, and it's going to be announced by the ram's horn. Exactly. And so, and this is where you get that motif of the shofar and redemption. And redemption is now placed from the beginning of time, and now you get the larger Jewish Akedah picture, okay? And this, in part, goes back to your question, which is, the sacrifice is preordained from the beginning of time because the sacrifice is essential to get redemption. The suffering of the Jews is built into the structure of the world because suffering is essential for redemption. And that idea that suffering is essential for redemption, which, by the way, becomes, as you know, the centerpiece of Christianity, but also exists as the centerpiece in Judaism. Because what precedes liberation? Slavery. Right, slavery. Is also, I think, in all fairness, built into the structure of human life. Right? It doesn't mean that you cause suffering in order to get redemption. It means that the way the world is built, suffering precedes redemption. You know what happens before the Messiah comes into the world? There's Chevlei HaMashiach, which means the birth pangs of the Messiah. And there is a perfect suffering precedes redemption, right? The pain of birth precedes birth. The pain of raising children precedes the growth of children. The pain of an apprenticeship in whatever field precedes success in that field. It's on and on and on. That's always a human motif that's very hard to erase in whatever the world is. And the Akedah, one of the reasons why it's so powerful is in capsule form, it's that motif. Okay, let me take two questions and then go on. One, two.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Right. I think that that's exactly right, and I will. Okay. So, right. yes, I think that that's exactly true. I mean, kids are fanatics by nature, right? Kids are very black and white. And when you grow up, if you grow up properly, you start to see gray. But you start off in black and white, which is why a kid's favorite phrase is, it's not fair. It's not fair. It's not fair. I don't care, though. It's not fair. But I know, but both of you have to get a portion. But it's not fair, right? Yeah. People have argued Holocaust before the state of Israel. And the only reason why we don't like, the only reason, I mean, it's a big reason, but the only reason why we don't like that paradigm is because the suffering was so enormous that it seems out of proportion to any possible reward. But we still believe in the possibility of that. Okay, I have so much material. Let me just do one or two things. I'm going to hand out to you next time. I just got from Mary Douglas, who is an anthropologist, the way in which the story works as a ring. The story of Abraham works as a ring. And I could explain it to you, but instead, next time I'm going to Xerox the chart, and you'll see an amazing thing. Then next time I'm also going to go over this story about a rabbi who makes the argument, true or not, the title of his article is Abraham Trusted God Would Stop Him. And I'll tell you his evidence. And then let me just, okay, so let me make one or two key comments, and then I'll read you a poem. I did last time, I read you that wonderful poem by Amichai, and I'll read you one more poem by Carmi on the Akedah. The one thing that I wanted to say preceding this was about what Heschel says about the Akedah. Heschel tells the story of a boy who each year when they would read the Akedah would be afraid that Abraham this time would do it. You know, he says every year that the kid would you know, get scared when Abraham lifts the knife, and the other students would make fun of him because they would say, you know, you haven't read this enough, you don't know that Abraham's not going to do it. And this is a Hasidic story, by the way. And the teacher says, no, that's exactly how you're supposed to read the story. That's the whole point of the story, is if you don't feel the fear each time Abraham brings the knife, you don't understand the story. Which, if you realize, I mean, if you watch a horror movie, even though you watch it the second time or the third time, if it's done well, you still feel the fear. That's part of what the movie is supposed to do. And here too, if you really imagine what happened, then you're supposed to feel the fear. And how the Bible achieves that effect is also something that we'll talk about next time when we go over that comparison between Homer and the Bible. But now I want to read you, I read last time that wonderful poem by Amichai. You know what, I'm going to read it again because it's a good setup then for the poem by Carmi, and then we'll close with any questions. Here's Amichai's poem again, which if you didn't hear it last time, it's called The True Hero of the Akedah. The true hero of the Akedah was the ram, who did not know about the pact among the others. It was as if he volunteered to die in place of Isaac. I want to sing for him a memorial song about the curly wool and the mortal eyes, about the horns that stood silent on its living head. After the slaughter, they were made into shofars to sound the blast of their wars and to sound the blast of their base celebrations. I want to remember that final image like a pretty photograph in a fancy fashion magazine. The tanned, pampered youth in the finest of frocks, and by his side the angel dressed in a long silk gown as if for a festive reception, and the two of them with desolate eyes looking out to two distant, desolate places, and behind them, as a colorful background, the ram, entangled in the thicket before slaughter, the thicket, his final friend. The angel departed homewards, Isaac departed homewards, and Abraham and God had parted ways a while back, but the true hero of the Akedah was the ram. And here is from Carmi, T. Carmi. The act called The Actions of the Fathers. And after the Akedah, then the most difficult test began. Abraham took his son to the camel races, hiked with him from the Euphrates to the Nile, swam by his side, watched him like a hawk in the waters of Eilat. And when they returned home, he slaughtered flocks and herds of plenty, tender and good, sweet scent of songs and muscle and meat, and guests in good graces come in from afar. Isaac ate and ate and ate and was silent. Abraham bought his wife a fur coat and golden jewelry and installed emergency lighting in their tent. He brought her boots in style from a shop on the Nile, hashish from Tarshish, cinnamon from Lebanon. Sarah, who grew old overnight, never took off her mourning clothes. Mourning as in sadness mourning, M-O-U. Abraham prayed to his God morning and evening. He hung tzedakah boxes on all the tamarisk trees, studied his Torah day and night, fasted, gave room and board to angels almost for no fee. The voice from on high disappeared. The only voice within him, the only one left, said, yes, you went from your land, from your homeland, the land of your father, and now, in the end, from yourself. Now, the reason I read them both is because both poems are poems about modern Israel. A modern poet doesn't only write about ancient stuff, okay? And you'll notice what Amichai in part is writing about is the difference between the fashion photograph and what really happens, which is that one person gets sacrificed and never comes home. And Carmi, the same thing. He's talking about the trauma afterwards, after the Akedah, and what do? You buy stuff, you install emergency lighting, you take every precaution, and you realize that in the end, after such a trauma, you're separated even from the sources of yourself. So the Akedah, which, by the way, is a source of a lot of material, and I have other poems here too, a lot of material in modern Israel. Stories have been written about it. There's a novel by Agnon, probably his most famous novel, Tmol Shel Shom, Only Yesterday, which was recently translated, that has the Akedah as a central theme, Agnon being the greatest modern Hebrew novelist, writer, the winner of the Nobel Prize, because the Akedah is in part the story of every Jewish generation, including modern Israel, which is why you have this book called The Last Trial by Shlomo Spiegel, who was a professor at the seminary, and by the way, for trivia buffs, was the brother. This professor of medieval Hebrew poetry was the brother of Sam Spiegel, who was one of the founders of the movies, right? One of the great movie moguls. His brother was Shalom Spiegel, who was a professor of medieval Hebrew poetry. And what Spiegel does is he collects poems from medieval times that talk about Jews who went through the Akedah, but was worse. Ephraim of Bonn is the main poem of the book, and he killed his own children rather than have them convert to Christianity. And the poem is all about, you know, basically, Avram, you think you went through a trial, but you were stopped, and we weren't. And Spiegel takes it apart, talks about the historical background and the literary background and so on. But there were any number of cases in the Middle Ages, and when I say any number, not thousands of cases, but there were a number of cases where Jews literally killed their own families rather than have them convert to Christianity, which, as you can imagine, aroused horror in the Christian community and great ambivalence in the Jewish community, right? Some rabbis were horrified, although they were careful to temper their condemnation, because they, you know, it was so terrible what people did and why they did it. And others actually supported it. But in every case, no matter what people decided, the story that they invoked was the Akedah. Yes?
Is that what happened at Masada?
Masada is another example. Yes?
But now that's a place that, you know, people
right.
go to.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about that. In fact, a modern Israeli political writer wrote a book called The Masada Complex, about whether Masada ought to be the place where you swear in soldiers, as opposed to, say, Beitar, which was the last fortress where soldiers were killed, as opposed to the last place where people committed suicide. But, you know, the truth is that symbols and history are not the same. And what Masada has come to mean is not necessarily what Masada was actually about, because it doesn't really matter so much to most people what the history was. It matters what the symbolism is. But the Akedah is a very, very powerful symbol. And next time, as I said, we're going to go through those things. And I'll just give you one or two. We have a minute. Let me just give you one or two of the modern comments to give you a flavor of the kind of things that we're going to talk about next time, if I can find it. Where did I just put it? I'll leave that for then. So the question is... The question that one writer who wrote a book about the Akedah, and which he gives different interpretations, and this goes back to what we said at the beginning, was he said, here's the central question of the Akedah. How does Abraham, the idol smasher, become the father who proceeds to obey God's request that he sacrifice his son? Okay, Abraham is an iconoclast, right? He protests at Sodom, he leaves the house of his father, and then he becomes this automaton. And the question of the Akedah for him is, how does that happen? And also, I meant to mention, there's a play, a modern Israeli play by Avraham Raz, who, after the Akedah, the play has Isaac grabbing Abraham and binding him on the altar. Right? Which, again, is a story about there's an Israeli psychologist who wrote a book that I have, which I have not read, but I read about it. And I have it. It's called Generations Apart. It's all about the struggle between generations, right? And that's clearly part of the subtext of this story, is the struggle between uh, between Avraham and Isaac. And, you know, and I have one more note in here to say that some Hasidim called the Jewish people the Akedah people, which makes sense in Jewish history. So anyway, all right. There's lots more stuff, but we'll come to that next time. Any final questions? If not, I'll send you off with one more poem, because you still have a second, and I have another poem. From Meir Wieseltier, okay? And this, you can hear in the opening of this poem, his Hasidic background. Again, a modern Hebrew poet, but with a Hasidic background. The only thing in the world that Abraham loved was God. He didn't love the gods of other men, which were made of wood or clay or polished vermilion, which were created by men who came home each evening to their wives to guzzle meat and wine, which were sold in the city market like onions to the highest bidder. He invented his own God and made himself his chosen one. And of everything that existed in the world, he loved only him, God. He didn't bow down to other gods. He said to them, if you go right, I'll go left. If you go left, I'll go right. He said, lest they say, I made him wealthy. He refused to take anything from anyone or give anyone anything except God. Him, all he had to do was ask, and he'd receive everything, even Isaac, the only one, the tender inheritor. But if there's a God, there's also an angel. He didn't appreciate anything in the world, only God. He never sinned to him. There was no difference between them. Not like Isaac, who loved his coarse-minded son. Not like Jacob, who slaved away for women, who limped from the blows that God gave him at night, who saw angelic ladders only in dreams. Not so Abraham, who loved God and whom God loved. And together, they counted the righteous of the city before they wiped it out. So there you have, and this is not uncommon in modern Israeli poetry, a criticism of the tradition. And you can understand why. Okay, again, remember where modern Israeli poets are coming from and what they're facing, right? And he's reading Abraham as a modern day fanatic. And that's his read of it. But it's important to hear that because, you know, I remember, I'll close with this story. Eliezer Shlomovic, who was my teacher and was a scholar of Midrash, of rabbinic literature, told me he was once sitting in synagogue next to Arnie Band. Arnie Band is a professor of modern Hebrew literature at UCLA, right? One of the world's great experts on Agno. And Eliezer Shlomovic pulled out his Midrash, and he was reading it. And Band says, you know, you and I do the same thing, only I do it 2,000 years later. That's what you get in modern Israeli literature, is modern Midrash. Amichai, Wieseltier, Carmi, they're all reading the same text as the rabbis did, but they're reacting as 20th and 21st century writers instead of second century writers, which is why it's beautiful to see, even if you disagree with their reading, you disagree with the Midrash sometimes. But it's good to see that the tradition is seamless and continues. Okay, next time, what the moderns have to say.